Good afternoon. This is a podcast runs through it. We're, as usual, in Sound Color Studios in downtown Livingston on an afternoon that, well, it's not a good afternoon, I guess, because the impeachment trial is coming to an end. And lots of other things are going on. I'm Nelson King. To my right here is Dixie Hart. As a reminder, we do have a webpage, apodcastrunsthroughit.com. And we would invite you to come to the website and look at what we have. A new section, which is, what's it called, Dixie? We have
it's our 2020 election page. And in addition to all of these great episodes that we've been posting, which will be available throughout the 2020 elections, you can also find information on which candidates are running, voter registration information, voter guides. There'll be information about ballot initiatives and that sort of thing. It's a great resource.
And also, most importantly, how to get yourself registered if you're not already. And again, it's a podcastrunsthroughit.com. I think we're ready to do what we need to press on with this afternoon, which is to interview a candidate for the House of Representatives, the United States House of Representatives. His name is Tom Winter. And I think you'll find it an interesting interview. He has a lot of good ideas that are worth listening to. As we mentioned, this afternoon we're going to be interviewing Tom Winter. Now, Tom is currently the representative at 96th District?
Yes, 96th.
Up in Missoula country. And you're now running for the United States House of Representatives, our representative at large, and which is, that name has kind of bothered me. We're a very big state, and at large means it's a lot of territory to cover, about a million people. So I think what we want to start with is, you obviously have been building up a very, I'd say busy track record in the Montana House, and now you want to move that over to the United States House of Representatives, and that's a big leap. And I want to get at, if we can, where you come from and why you want to make this kind of a leap, and what's your motivation here, as they say in the theater business. But anyway, let's just start with some of your background. I'll let you tell the story.
Sure. So first off, thanks for having me. It's always good to be driving all around the state and in the day and like a nice room where people want to talk to you. This morning we started out in Billings and we were in Crow Agency, Lame Deer, Colstrip, and then Forsyth. And we had meetings in every place.
Wow.
And so when you're saying at large, you know, we gassed up the car twice just this morning. And that says, you know, we're putting miles on the car, but it shows the difficulty and I think the rewards of campaigning in an at large seat. No Democrat nationwide has an at large seat currently. And so when you're doing this and trying to build politics that will win across this whole state, I was just struck with it this morning with the breadth of people we met, what their concerns were. I mean, clearly, you know, Colstrip is one place that it needs a lot of help and needs good government. And I was just struck with that. And then coming here, it just makes it more rewarding, I'd say, than campaigning in a little tiny district on the outskirts of Philadelphia or something. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I love Montana. I like to be able to drive around it. So anyway, you were asking about my background, right?
Mm-hmm.
So my name's Tom Winter. I'm a state legislator. I'm 33 years old. And before this, before I made the reckless decision to get involved in government and public service, I practiced as an EMT. I also had a home health care business with my family. And I only got involved in politics for the smallest of reasons, which is true. My family member with a chronic illness that means that makes it difficult for her to kind of do a lot of things and have a life that is fulfilling. She has to work harder than the rest of us to get out of bed each day and to get things done and to finish school and go to work. It's difficult for her. And with the knowledge of that, I saw my state rep at the time made the mistake of calling people who are on Medicaid expansion freeloaders and saying that he just wanted to cut 50% of them. And he was just talking so callously about people that were like, I knew, and people that, mm-hmm. I was dealing with family, we might have had to be on that program, and I knew people had been. And it was just so cruel and meaninglessly so. Like, why talk this way? Why be this way? Why do we, even if you are being rewarded electorally by being so callous, we have to change the incentive structure. We got to do something different here. So I ran for office, did not know what that would mean. And then, I mean, it was a state, this is a state house race. People think those are, you know, they're not that big a deal. It's, I mean, it's true they aren't, but in a way, it became my whole life in the end.
Right.
Sold my house. I moved into my sister's basement. I farmed out my two dogs to my family members. Everything got put on hold, and we knocked 22,000 doors in a district with 4,000 doors total in the western part of Missoula County. So everyone in the entire state, including most people in Missoula, think we're all like wearing like tie-dye and, you know, sandals in the winter. And that's mostly true, except for my district, I'd say, which is outside of the city limits partly. So it's, if you go down Reserve Street, which is where the Walmart is and all that, it's to the western side. It goes out to Houston. So that district was held by a Republican previously, obviously, and also voted for President Trump plus 11 points. And I knew that this was going to be a really tough haul. I'd never done this kind of thing before, so I didn't know what to expect. And I probably wouldn't have gotten involved if I knew what it would,
right.
What it would lead me here. This is a tough road. But again, we knocked 22,000 doors. And what I found is that we were able to learn more going door to door about the community and actually kind of weave the community back together after all these things have happened politically and otherwise in our state and nationally. And what I would learn from one conversation with someone on their front porch would lead to the next person and talking about what they were concerned about. And we kind of got people working together on things. And so that got me there to the state house, and it was a long road. It really was. But it was so worthwhile. And in truth, and this is just, you're asking personal things. This is, I'm still trying to learn how to talk about myself on these things. When people ask, I always want to talk about policy and things. So this is, I want to say it right, but this was the first thing I'd ever done that had really been truly fulfilling. And I actually understood when people love their jobs or when they talk about getting up and figuring out what they do today might have an impact. I had no idea I would find that. I didn't know I hadn't found it. I liked my life before. But it turns out that I also really like driving from Crow Agency to Lame Deer to Colstrip to Forsyth to Livingston in one day, hopefully in the service of Montanans. And I do like that, and I didn't know that. So just personally already, this has been, the last couple of years have been the best and most difficult years of my life, and that's because they're involved in service, and I didn't know that. So if there's a takeaway from my little rant about this, anyone listening, if you can get involved in public service in some way, Montana offers a wealth of options, more so than almost any other state. We have the chance to run a whole state. You can be in the state legislature part-time. They're not all so hard to win as mine. Republican, Democrat, the more people who are involved, I've learned, the better. And we are impoverished by the idea that it's difficult to do and that it takes, or that it's ugly. And it's worth doing regardless. So I guess that's, if I want anything from people learning about my personal life doing this and where I came from, it's that you can do it too, and it's not that difficult. So.
Well, it seems like you went through, I would say, an intense canvassing opportunity. And I don't want to stretch this metaphor too long, but in a way, it's a little like working as a law enforcement or policeman, that you're going to meet a lot of people, and not all of them are great, not all of them are friendly. And some are really wonderful, and it cuts across all lines. And a lot of politicians don't like that kind of face-to-face with voters. Yeah. What was it about you that seemed to respond to that?
I'm clearly crazy. I don't know. I truly, what I have found is the most difficult part of running for the congressional seat, for the federal office now, is that I don't get to go door to door. And I don't get to meet people. I mean, this is actually great because I'm talking to real people. It doesn't happen that often. And a lot of time you got to spend on the phone trying to raise money. And I don't know what it is about me personally. It's not really me, I think. I've gotten to know a lot of people who are in the state legislature and people who are in public service. And there's a cohort of people my age, and well, and of all ages, but specifically kind of rising generation in their late 20s, early 30s, who for mundane reasons, like I was concerned about my family's health care or insurance was too high, I couldn't afford my mortgage, or these things that are like non-political, non-ideological worries that lead to public service. And I think there's a lot of us being activated that way.
We've noticed it, the people we've interviewed.
We've definitely noticed that.
And a very high level, too. I mean, very competent, very well-educated, articulate people who've had some personal experience along the way. I mean, yours is not unique in the sense that it's a healthcare thing.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you should realize that I think among many of the people we've interviewed, it's the healthcare issue is so personal, and it translates into national, if not global, interest because it touches on so many other things. I noticed looking at some of the things you worked on while you were in the legislature, quite a lot of them had to do with healthcare, although we have a very long list of initiatives or bills or anything, you know. But maybe let's talk a little bit about healthcare. Sure. I assume that that's one of your priorities.
Of course.
You, a lot of them. And you bring some interesting ideas to it. I think you attempted to do some things in the legislature that were, besides the Medicaid issue, but other things as well. How did you approach healthcare when you were working in the legislature?
You know, that's a good question. In the way that, my biggest thing was I wanted to be elected, and then I wanted to get on Health and Human Services, which is the committee for people, for the, including me. I didn't know until I was on it. It is a committee on the state legislature that works with Health and Human Services within the state of Montana. I wanted to be there for one, because I wanted to be a champion for Medicaid expansion, which meant that 110,000 people could keep their health care. But I also wanted to be there to understand the healthcare landscape in the state. And what I found was, and I think anyone who's on that committee, regardless of party, is that it's pretty disheartening. We are always faced continually with shortages, lack of access, right, lack of doctors. It is a certain way, it is a bad way, and it does not need to be that way. And we have come to accept it for whatever reason, and I don't know why. Because I don't accept it. Truthfully, most days were pretty horrible, and that was just for me listening to what people had to say. I can only imagine coming in and having to talk about your family, like not being able to find a doctor in the state who can help you, and not being able to afford to go to Seattle to do that and to save your loved one. People are put in a lot of positions that they shouldn't have to be put in. In a decent society, they wouldn't have to do it, and there's just a fundamental indecency to the way it's being handled, and I struggle to have the words for why it's still acceptable to everybody. Other than that, I actually truthfully don't think people accept it. There's just no way to talk about it.
Right.
It is so the lived experience of someone who is seriously ill in Montana and can't afford to fly somewhere else, or can't afford to fly their kid who's sick somewhere else, is devastating.
Right.
And it's a stain on all of us that we don't talk about it and work to help those people.
Yeah, I think it touches certainly every family that I've ever encountered,
yes,
maybe most individuals as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's universal. You don't have to go very far before people will mention, we had a problem with the healthcare system. Mm-hmm. They may not talk about it that way, but that's what they're talking about.
Right. And in a lot of cases, I think it's like you said, people just don't even know who do you talk to.
Yes.
How do you, you know, who can answer your questions? And particularly in eastern Montana, where there may not be a doctor in your community.
There are not doctors in those communities. It's not May. I'm sorry, but I was just speaking with someone just before this, my previous meeting. There are not doctors in those communities.
Yes.
That's not a community in my case.
Right.
I mean, I'm not calling out Glasgow. I'm saying that is a place that is hurting. If Glendive doesn't have a doctor, Glendive is at a serious deficit. That's not a functioning place. We have to acknowledge that and make sure that Glendive does have a doctor.
Absolutely.
Communities without health care are not well, healthy, functioning communities.
Right. Or why does Glendive have a brand new, relatively new hospital, but they don't have doctors to staff it?
Yes.
You know, I mean...
Well, I mean, staffing is its own...
When you go to the legislature and you find out that there's opposition to doing things, you have to ask yourself the question, what is it about not having enough doctors in a hospital that's partisan? That isn't a bipartisan issue that shouldn't be tackled.
Who doesn't want to fix that?
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, and I would often throw my hands up and wonder that. And I.
Do you know now?
In truth, I do know now. I do know. But I also, and I, this is not some fake, I really dislike the kind of surface plea for unity amongst parties or different people who are different ideologically from you. I really do think the people in that room are very concerned about the direction the state's going, and they do have a baseline like love for Montana and where they live and their community. I don't doubt that. They're not, at least in the state legislature, it's not a glamorous job. There's no power to it. It is difficult and oftentimes really boring. You don't get paid. I mean, it's tough. You know, I mean, no one wants to spend their vacation day in February in Helena, Montana. No offense to Helena, please vote for me there. But like, I mean it. So the people who are there for a reason. Sometimes it's difficult to divine why. And sometimes it seems like they're there to, truthfully, to hurt other people. but I think I still have to have, and I do still have to have faith that that's not the case on their part. They are either misguided or I am misguided in my understanding of what they're trying to accomplish. And it's totally possible that's the case with me. So,
well, I noticed that in this last cycle, things got done.
Yes.
More than they have been, certainly in two or three election cycles. And I've been asking people who were in the legislature what was going on. Why did things get done? Even though the opposition, the polarization, it was all still there. But was there an epiphany somewhere along the line that they had to work on something?
I think with Medicaid expansion shows that they're like what I was talking about. I don't think not one party has a lock on decency and understanding of the suffering and hurt of others and the need for good governance. And we saw that with Medicaid expansion. People cross party lines to vote for something. Now, of course, if you want to go, take it a little higher, maybe go to 30,000 feet, why did the state of Montana feel the need to reexamine a broadly successful program that helped our constituents?
Right.
Why did we need to have that fight anyway? Go back there and I'll talk to you. And that's something that's a deeper issue. But we got through it. We did accomplish something, which was continuing the program. And there were many things we moved forward on. I mean, MMIW, I was just speaking with Representative Peppers. And what she pushed for took a lot of effort. And I know, and I now know more, how difficult it was for her to do that. And the idea that someone, that she would ever face opposition in our state house to trying to help missing and murdered Indigenous people is astonishing to me. But we did get something done, and that is through her persistent effort. She found a lot of pushback. And so I truly don't know how to answer your question as to how it happened. I know that individual people did heroic efforts to make sure it did. And I know there's more to it than that system-wise in the state legislature. But, I mean, if you look at Ray as a case study, that is the efforts of one person and one community that elected her. And we wouldn't have that bill. I don't think we'd be talking as much about the disappearance of women in Native communities as we are now. She really contributed to and sparked a nationwide conversation. And that is something that really needs to be talked about in terms of the power of individuals who get into the legislature to make change.
Let's shift gears a little bit. You're running for the House of Representatives at the federal level. And I think almost all of us know what happens to healthcare bills when they get there. I'm sure you're aware of the differences between the state and the federal. Mm-hmm. When you get to the House, the scrutiny is higher, the pressure's higher. How do you feel about that?
I'm excited for the higher scrutiny and pressure because the pressure's the same in the state legislature, actually.
Right.
I'm assuming, actually even more, because we don't have staff. We are just flying alone. That is us, and that's unusual in state legislatures. So I was doing 24 bills. I felt incredible pressure and added pressure because of what I was trying to accomplish. But, it'll be nice to hopefully get there and have some support staff so that we know what we're doing sometimes and we can turn to experts. But the scrutiny is one thing I think that you can turn to your advantage too. The problem with state legislatures and oftentimes with places with small media markets, so, there's been some hollowing out of journalism here in Montana that's been pretty, we've lost a lot of good institutions, a lot of good people who would normally be reporting on things. I want scrutiny. I want people to report on what I'm doing so that I can move my agenda forward for the state. So the more people are talking about Montana, the more people are talking about what, and if I win this primary and this general, the more people are talking about what I'm trying to accomplish for Montanans and the concerns we have here and how they apply nationally, the better. So they bring on the scrutiny. I want that. And anyone who wants to be especially a congressperson, there's 435 people there. You truthfully need to learn how to work the media. You need to learn how to get that scrutiny because otherwise you're just going to be lost. And or truthfully, and if I may, you're going to be Gray Gianforte, who just hides from the media.
Right.
And that's even worse because it's a, federal office is a bully pulpit. It is an important place, and I think we saw that to ill effect and positive effect. I mean, today I think we saw it for negative effect, this being the day when President Trump was acquitted and the State of the Union was yesterday. That's showing the scrutiny to be used for negative ends. But there are positive ways to do it, too.
Right. Well, how disheartening is it going to be, though, when you're there, you're going to be working probably harder than you ever did in the state, but knowing that unless the Senate changes, mm-hmm. that all your efforts are just going to go pile up on Mitch McConnell's desk.
I mean, all my efforts in the state legislature piled up on someone's desk, too. I passed 4 bills, which is a record for a freshman, I believe, and there's a record amount to bring anyway, 24. But 20 of them died. Uh-huh. You know that. You move the ball forward, and you're contributing to the conversation, which is back to what you were saying about scrutiny. If I'd been able to get anyone to talk about the bills I was doing, I would have been – that was the point. I wanted to spark conversations. Right. And some of the bills were esoteric and boring, and I would struggle to actually right now, a year later, I would struggle to give you the bullet points on them without a pointer. But in the moment, I could have recited every single aspect of the way that the Board of Investments was involved in an idea to allow Montanans to use the power of the state's investments to get better private sector pensions. I would have begged someone to ask me about that. No one did. So I want, maybe things will die. They always do. And if you're in a fight and you're losing, you're probably doing the right thing anyway. Mm-hmm. So it's still a noble cause.
What is it about you that can look at a list of issues and come up with 24 bills? No, I mean, seriously, I'm not mocking the fact that that's a large number, but something about you must take the general and look for the specific somehow. What is it that...
Yeah, I think so. I mean, truly, in the state house was different. I ran... Well, no, it's not at all. It's how I'm doing it now. So I ran on... When I was talking about how I went from door to door and talked with what the community was looking for, I incorporated concerns that I heard a lot about into my platform and then pledged to write bills based on the platform.
Right.
Which I actually did. So about more than a dozen of those bills directly came out of a little walk card, which I know sounds kind of gimmicky and stupid, but I did. I promised. I told people what I was going to do. I listened to what my future constituents wanted, and I incorporated that into a piece of paper I handed out to every single person I met, which was the entire district because I knocked 22,000 doors. And I did exactly what I said I would do. So that's where they come from. Truly, they didn't come from me. They came from the concerns of the community. And then I threw on some other ones because once I was there, I was like, this needs to change.
And then I assume you have to learn how to do that.
And I'm not an attorney.
Yeah.
And that makes it more difficult. So I really am. That's where the citizen legislature argument, and also where the U.S. House is supposed to be the direct will of the people, which can be a sometimes kind of scary thing. I was always at a disadvantage because I didn't go to law school, but I was also helped because I was asking questions that sometimes were stupid, but also were not, because they would lead to different ways of phrasing or working through different ideas and bills. So,
yeah. Well, when you get to the Senate, and then that was a slip of the tongue, but
yeah,
the House of Representatives is quite a different animal, of course, than even the state legislature, and I'm. The reason I'm digging a little bit here is
Please.
Because I think people need to understand that when you shift gears, when you go to a higher level of government, that it brings with it, you bring with it certain approaches.
Yeah.
All right. Which, well, I'll take one example because it's current and people are somewhat familiar with it. But when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez got in, AOC, got in, she had a ton of ideas and she hit the place like a whirlwind. And she did very well. But the institution, even on her own party, started to try to sit on her and drop it down, girl. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, we know you're bright. We know you're going to get a lot done. But, you know, there's a resistance. Mm-hmm. And I have a sense you have some of that might happen to you. How do you feel about that?
I bring on the resistance. Organizations and structures in government need to adapt, or they won't, and they'll gain and increasingly become irrelevant. So that resistance will be there always. And I find that in my campaign now. I mean, I truthfully, a lot of the reason I'm running for a federal office here is because I'm concerned about the way that our politics are going, Democrat and Republican, but specifically my concern is the viability and continued health of the Democratic project in the state of Montana and the politics of our state and the way that they can infect the way that neighbor talks to neighbor. And so, AOC is someone who I don't necessarily agree with on all policy, but she's a person who we are the same generation. And I share the idea with her and many other people who we don't talk about who are in the U.S. House and the Senate, that government can be a force for good, and we don't need to we don't have to apologize for that. And we don't have to bind ourselves by what I would say a lot of hidebound people who've been involved for a little too long are saying. So I look up to her ability to set the conversation and sometimes break things that need to be broken. She's done a good job there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there are some people who think the Democratic Party should learn a little bit of that too. but the reason I keep working on this a little bit is that you're learning how to do your job, basically. Uh-huh. And if you went to the House of Representatives at the federal level, it's learning all over again, and it's a different scale. And I'm sure that you would find that you have to do things differently, even though you have learned to do one approach here. What else are you, if you get to the federal level, what other are your priorities? What sorts of things do you think you can work on there?
So, did I cut you off? I'm sorry. I'm jumping on this because this is kind of something I've been talking about a lot, which is I don't really believe in litmus tests politically. I think they're kind of, but personally, I can apply them to myself because I can be unfair to myself all the time. So I view, when we're talking in the campaign, you've seen, you know, I have a lot of ideas, but also the only candidate has my plans, my platform out on my website. And it does change every once in a while when I find out more information. I have been wrong, or I have found more information and needed to attack things from a different angle. And that's the point of what I put it out there, so you know where I stand. And if you disagree, you can tell me, and or hopefully you can inform me so I can change it. And what I am looking for with all those bills and with kind of what I'm trying to accomplish in a larger sense is moving any federal policy toward working families. If something doesn't, if we have a policy that we're working on that isn't going to be beneficial or helpful to a working mom in Scobie or to, a family living in my district outside of Missoula, or a young person in Billings who's trying to get a degree at MSUB or something, we're failing. We're not doing the right thing. And I think that the Democratic Party nationally, and I would also agree with the Republicans, really our politics has lost sight of what the true purpose of government is. And that's a big one. That's the one. So everything I talk about or do, it's always asking, will this help that person thrive and be healthy and be successful and be prosperous? Will it help their towns and their cities be prosperous, good places to live? And Montana used to do that. I think that used to be kind of a litmus test for our politics. And, you know, we've always kind of gone our own way. And it comes, I think, from a concern for working people and for families that are trying to make it in a place that can be kind of difficult sometimes. And we all have that experience living here. We've applied it to the way we do our politics. And you see the echo of that. But I'm trying to bring it back from being an echo and say it a bit louder. Mm-hmm. And so when you're saying, what would I think also kind of the question you might be asking, if I can put words in your mouth here, is like, why do this? Why go to Congress? And then also, you're 33 years old. What the hell do you know? You've only been in the Montana legislature. There's no telling what happens and someone can bend you to their own ends. Well, I can tell you that that is my litmus test personally for any policy. If it helps a working person, and if it helps a working family, people who struggle, people who build the state every day, I am for it. And that will lead me probably, if I manage to pull this off, in some strange directions. Strange because they don't necessarily follow party lines, an ideology that's kind of set in, but they will lead me in the right direction. And that's the only one I care about. So I'm very confident that I'll be able to handle this for that very reason, because it's an easy answer.
Struck by something on your website. All politicians going around saying, oh, I'm going to create jobs. I'm going to create jobs. And it's fine. Okay, we get it. But you were one of the few that broke it out and said, what kind of jobs?
Yeah.
That there are, right now, we're not just talking about, you know, daddy getting one good job and paying for the whole family. That doesn't work like that anymore, you know. You're talking about almost the entire family working, and maybe daddy and mommy both have two jobs. Mm-hmm. And that's the reality of jobs. And that's a whole different labor/social issue that, you know, often doesn't get addressed. And I noticed you mentioned that on your website, that you seem to have an awareness that when you talk jobs and economics, you're not just talking these simple ideas that, employer comes in, he has 50 jobs. Great, wonderful. Except that half of them are part-time, and you know what I mean?
Or they have no benefits.
Yeah.
Or they won't hire women. Mm-hmm. I mean, it still happens. I agree. And I would also, when I'm talking about that on the website, one of the things I'm really concerned about too is we all have seemed to internalize this idea, like whatever the New York Times says about the economy, whatever the Wall Street Journal says, like the economy is doing great. The stock market's great, so it must mean it's great to be in Montana. We can't afford to live in the cities anymore. The jobs we have require us to have two jobs to even rent an apartment in these places. And healthcare is unaffordable and not provided by your employer. So sure, the economy's doing great because the stock market's doing great. How many of us own stock in any meaningful amount? I don't even know how to do it, truthfully.
Exactly. Or how many people even have a savings account? And if they, you know, if they did, how disappointed would you be with the interest you're getting on money you're putting away? I mean, those are, most people can relate to a good economy that way. And
economy's not really good if it doesn't serve working people. Yeah. It's the truth. And also, I mean, you know, there's some famous thing that everyone bandies about, but it is true, apparently. You know, what is it? Most Americans wouldn't be able to handle a $400 hit.
Yes, an emergency $400.
Yes. I count myself as one of them every once in a while. I hear you. Wow. And it's one of those things that we're dealing with this issue that is, again, it goes kind of unremarked upon. The economy's great, but most of us don't have $400. If I get into a fender bender, I can't fix my car.
Yeah, you're wiped out financially.
I'm wiped out, and I'm alone. I'm lucky. Yeah. It's a perverse thing to say that I can feel confident to say in front of a microphone, I'm lucky because I'm alone. But I am lucky because I don't have other people to depend on me. I can only imagine being a single parent or being married or being committed to somebody and having only $400 to do this. And have to rely on them or vice versa. It leads to so many different ways that families and people's ambitions and their needs are really put on hold while we all talk about how great the economy is doing. Right. It's just not.
And it's real stressful, you know, so you go back to healthcare.
Yeah, exactly. You go back to healthcare. I mean, the thing is, too, like, the $400 issue, healthcare, your people's deductibles are $10,000,
right,
which is essentially not healthcare. You're never going to make it there. And we have people still going bankrupt in this country for healthcare needs. Some people, I mean, in Ohio, there was that story of that woman who couldn't make her payments on some recent cancer treatment. They put her in jail. She was undergoing cancer treatment. And I have close family also that are, my father has suffering from early onset Alzheimer's. Thank God he has long-term care insurance. He did that years ago. I didn't understand why, but I'm a young guy. He's not that old. He's 60. He's going to be so mad that I forgot. He's 61. He's too young to be dealing with this, and he is. My family has suffered. This is not good for us, and it's not good for him, and it's sad. But the fact that I immediately got off the phone with him, I was like, at least he'll be taken care of. Should not be after I get terrible news over the phone, my first thought shouldn't be, at least it's not going to bankrupt us. Mm. But that's the case.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, I notice also that you're aware of the fact that when you talk about the economy and jobs, that there are other, like, for example, childcare or equal pay.
Mm-hmm.
There are other elements of it, which, again, goes back to the quality of employment, you know, that you want. And you seem to be more aware of that than a lot of people. I mean,
because I've had bad jobs.
Yeah, and you have an ability to translate that experience into, okay, what's it going to take to not have bad jobs?
Yeah. Hmm?
Or at least have an idea of how to approach that legislatively, which is...
Well, and that sort of brings us to the fact that in Montana, if you're lucky enough to have a union job, you've got a good job. And we got some news that you might want to share with us, a historical factor about your campaign in Montana.
Yes, we were the first campaign in Montana history to unionize our staff. And which was truly much more difficult than I thought it would be, but it was worth doing. And when I found out that we'd be the first, I didn't know. I looked around. I was like, "Wow, we're already history making. Look at that!" I was also disappointed because we have a strong union character in this state. We do have strong union jobs still. I mean, the state was essentially built by unions in Butte and Anaconda,
right?
And the fact that our politics has not kept up with that. I mean, we're about 80 years late on unionizing our campaigns, I'd say. And I am disappointed in the politics of this state, that it took me to think that it was the right thing to do and then to do it and then find out later that it was the first. It's a sorry commentary on what we've actually been trying to do for a long time.
It is, but it's also a really, it's a little ray of light for the future.
I know,
of
it was great.
Montana politics, you know, because, I mean, and people working for your campaign have to be pretty grateful for that.
Well, one of the things that I had found, and the reason it even came up was when I ran for the State House, I had seen how it's difficult to be a campaign worker. Again, I didn't know I'd be doing any of this. So all of a sudden, I'm running for the State House. I am in this room full of other people working in other campaigns. I'm meeting all these fascinating people from out of state who dedicate their lives to working for candidates. I never met anyone like that. I just saw the ways that they could be taken advantage of. They're young. They're working right. So hard. You know, 90 days on with one day off for vacation is not acceptable working conditions. Being alone with your supervisor in a room at night is not necessarily a good working condition. These campaigns and the way we run them have to be informal necessarily. I mean, I drove with campaign staff this morning at 6 a.m. for 500 miles. That's not normal in a normal job. We have to ensure that not only are they baseline just safe in their work environment, but also have ways to pursue grievances, be paid enough to actually make a living. And then I think for the candidate, I just want to be able to sleep at night. So what am I going to do? Go around saying I care about working Montanans and then pay peanuts to my staff? Like, I have to work with them every day and look them in the eye.
I think others have.
They have.
That's happened.
That's sort of been the practice.
But also, that's part of the practice. But that's right. The thing. I don't fault previous candidates for doing that. They were never given the option. We need to have the political change and the understanding that we have to live our values at every moment.
Right.
And it's just, I don't know, I faced some pushback on doing so, and people kind of groaned like, you're going to go bankrupt because you have to pay your staff. And I kind of wanted to say, like, you're telling me we have a political system in which the Democrats will tell other Democrats that you're going to go bankrupt if you live the values that we all are supposed to be talking about. We have created a system.
That's insane.
It was just so frustrating.
Yeah. And you can let other campaigns and candidates off the hook, but we're old enough now where we don't have to. You know? We can say it's about damn time.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like Social Security and other. We live it, and you've living some of it. I don't want to harp on this, but I think that it's interesting that a lot of what you now talk about in terms of legislation actually stem from something you lived or deal with personally, and that's an element that all too often in this. Fake ideology that we're dealing with right now.
Yeah.
It's quite clear, and I want to make it clear to our people that when we interview Democrats, the baseline should be government can do something. And sometimes it can do it very well, but you have to be able to distinguish what it can do and what it can't do. And you're not talking about, you know, big government and big. Well, in your own literature, there's kind of thread of, I guess you could say, populism. You know, that watch out for big government, watch out for big business, big anything.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, government is an instrument and can do things. You seem to embody that. I mean, that's a...
I appreciate that. I mean, I'm trying to get that through. I mean, government done well expresses the will of the people and the will of the community. And the will of the community and the will of the people should be their own well-being. I believe in that. And I think that's been lost through all this hyper-partisanship and ideological warfare that's based on...
Yeah.
I'm not exactly certain what, like a bad reading of a Reagan speech from before I was born. This sounds flippant, and I don't mean it this way. I just don't particularly care. Things are bad enough, fix it, do it. And if you're not going to do it, get out of the way, because someone else is going to do it, and they're going to do it wrong.
Right.
We have a massive opportunity at this point in our nation and in our state to reorient things back to the way they were. And that's not make America great again. That's a reminder that the way that things are now don't have to be this way. We made a choice. Generations before us made a choice. We make a choice every day. And if we decide to continue with this, even if just throwing your hands up, that is making a choice. And we deserve what we get if we make the choice to continue the status quo.
Right.
Yeah, and that brings up something that's also on your website, taxes. Because it's part of the jobs, part of the economy, also part of healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that you have some positions about taxes and who should be taxed and how they should be taxed. And
I do, yeah. And I can go back, actually, this is where I will go back to the state legislature, because there was a bill that I put forward that was brought as an idea by one of my constituents, who was actually fairly conservative. I imagine he was Republican, I don't know. But there was concern in my district and that they were that it's a largely middle class, I'd say working class district, that they are paying too much in taxes in the state. And the state is financed by working class people and not by wealthier people. It actually, if you work for a living, you probably pay a bigger share of your income to the taxes, than someone who doesn't, who has passive income, who owns multiple ranches or who owns multiple businesses. They probably pay less than someone who works and makes a good living, but not extravagant. And we need to right that imbalance. And I'm trying to do that in my proposals here. In my case with the Statehouse one, it's astonishing is how far we've gone in our economy and our politics that you could zero out all property taxes for every person in the state of Montana with a home valued under $450,000 with a 0.25% tax on second homes worth over $1 million. So what I'm saying is almost everyone in the state would not pay any more property taxes if we just fairly taxed Californians and New Yorkers' second homes at the Yellowstone Club and at Big Sky. And we're in Livingston, right around here.
In the Paradise Valley.
They wouldn't feel it. But I would imagine that a couple hundred extra bucks in the pocket of a working person who, a family of three with two parents who work as stockers at Walmart might feel a little better. And it might mean also that they, have more money to invest in their community and start their own business. And I look at that as kind of a, by the way, that was killed immediately, bipartisan, in the state legislature. I never really understood why. There was never a reason given. The committee meeting went great. It was just considered preposterous. And I wanted to say, what exactly about this mm-hmm. is preposterous? I mean, John Mayer's going to have to pay an extra $20,000 on his third home that he has down in the Paradise Valley. I mean, and also, John Mayer, I know you're a Democrat, please support me. But like, I mean it. It was weird that this was thought of as so crazy that we could immediately do good for our constituents. And I want to bring that to the federal level as well. I mean, John Mayer's of the world, be prepared to pay your fair share. And that's not an ideological question. That's a question of fairness in the American economy and in our politics. If you have accrued and won and worked very hard to build a business, to be successful, and you have not done that alone. And acknowledging that is the first step to understanding what community is about. If you built a trucking empire across the country, you did it on roads that we paid for. And all of us paid for it. And you will also pay for your fair share to what brought you your greatness and what brought you your ability to really shine in our society, in our economy. So I think there's a place, it's not meant to be like punitive toward the rich or anything like that.
Right.
It's an acknowledgement that you don't get there without the help of others. And also, and this is just something I truly don't understand as someone who's not really, really rich, who wants to live in a country where people can't afford healthcare and are going to literally being put in jail because they can't afford their cancer treatments? You can't buy your way out of that moral stain. You can have a beach house in Miami and a ski house in Montana and live in California or wherever. I would ask you, like, what is it costs something to live in the world when it's in a really, really unjust place and you're a part of that unjustness. And if anything, I would want to get out of it. I would want to make it right. And so I do think that, we're seeing this on both sides. I mean, it's clear that we're going to see some tax reform. It's clear that that's going to hopefully, I think, fall in where it should, which is a more fair tax system. But just morally, I do think there's appetite for this to go back to what it was before.
Well, again, I just want to say that's, that all sounds really great, but you're going to a place where unless, it's just so divided that unless we get the Senate back, the U.S. Senate, then the house.
I'm dead in the water. Yeah. Everything I'm saying is going to run into a buzzsaw.
Yeah. That just would be so demoralizing, I would think.
It won't, though, truly.
How do you deal with that?
You don't have to. Talking about these things, getting this out there right now is part of what I want to do. I mean, I stress that I'm young, but I only do it. It's partly humility and also because this is a lifetime project. And this is the project of a lifetime for a lot of people. And a lot of people that aren't necessarily out there saying it, they might not know that this is what they're doing, but I see it all the time when I talk to them, don't get to go door to door anymore, but anyone helping out their community and involving themselves, we are going to suffer more defeats than we are wins throughout our lives. And we might lose in the end entirely. But I don't really know what the other option is. There isn't one.
Let me just shift gears a bit on to what's your future going to be with the climate emergency? All right. And the fact that we have people, young people here in the town who are saying basically, I don't want to have kids.
I hear it from my friends too.
Because it doesn't look good. And those kids have to live that future, right? So you're going to be, I know you have some pretty specific stances on this, and you should express them, but just what Dixie was talking about, when you go to the federal level, the entrenched partisanship and the entrenched polarity on these issues are beyond belief, right? Mm-hmm. I've kicked the football in your direction.
Yeah, it's...
We're looking at your generation.
Yes, thank you.
Come on, you guys.
We appreciate this opportunity. It starts with politics in the sense of, like, we're not taking fossil fuel money in this campaign. And I actually got some pushback for that. Like, what do you have against... I don't have anything against people who work in the industry. I was just in Colstrip this morning. The issue is not... When we talk about climate change, I think we're going to run into these issues of... People will try to divide us, and interests that prefer, I guess, the planet to die would prefer. Those interests are going to continue to try and divide people by acting as if this is like workers versus elites, or right. This is Republicans versus Democrats, or people in the cities versus people in rural areas. We're all going to bake, so let's just all put that to rest right now. The catastrophe will hit you wherever it hits you if the world goes 2 degrees above its current level. I don't know what to say about that. We know that. That's not alarmist anymore. It's happening. We're going to get to 1 degree, and we're going to have to deal with that already. We've made that bed. Now we have to sleep in it. But moving forward, it has to start with our politics. So we don't take fossil fuel money. We also try to orient, I think, the response to climate change and the climate crisis toward, again, working people. And it's not a gimmick. It's like the Colstrip is a perfect example. That community pulled coal out of the ground and burned it for the betterment of the United States. It kept the lights on and the heater going in Seattle on cold days and in Portland as well. It built thriving West Coast cities. It also built Montana.
It built Montana, yes.
Yeah, the Coal Trust Fund. I mean, I know that from the state legislature. This state and the states around us were dependent on places like Colstrip. And the people and the families that built Colstrip should not be demonized for doing so. And I think we really run the risk sometimes of acting like people who work in like a carbon-intensive industry, like power generation, like pulling coal out of the ground, are the problem. And that's not the case. The individuals who did that didn't know. None of us did, or we would have stopped burning the coal, or apparently we didn't. And now that we do, we're changing. But we have an obligation federally to the people in those towns who have done that for a living and to that town and community itself to make it right. And I say that actually very specifically because the state governments can't get together, and Montana can't force Seattle or force Washington State to help out families in Colstrip now that they won't buy our power. We that's not how that works. The federal government, however, can. The federal government can act as a lever to ensure that when we make these transitions to non-baking the planet to hell economies, that it's fair.
And well, wasn't the coal severance tax
supposed
designed
to be?
To take care of that? I mean,
oh, you
not
mean the
only
piggy bank we use to finance most of everything else in the state?
Well, it hasn't been completely robbed of.
That's
I think
true.
There's still $1 billion in there.
That's true.
But the coal severance tax, I thought, was designed not just to reclaim the land, but also to stabilize an economy.
Yes, I agree. But I think we're going to see coal severance tax is Montana specific, but we're going to have
right.
to, and I, you know, if I'm running for the Congress, I think I have to have an answer for this nationally. And I'd be one of the few Democrats representing a resource extraction state, like a big Western state like this. And we have to do right by the communities that are going to be harmed and by the individual people and Americans that are going to be harmed as we make this transition. Or else, in truth, there are two reasons to do it. It's morally the right thing to do, but also politically, because what do we want to, we cannot create another group of people who hate for reasons that are not about climate change efforts to curb it.
Right.
We're not going to, if it's not a just, morally just transition, it's not worth doing. And also it won't be accomplished because this economy is so deeply dependent on carbon intensive industry. So there's going to need to be a robust federal aspect to it. And I mean like, and you know, I'm speaking slightly out of school here, so I have to be careful, but I believe communities like Colstrip are going to be coming up more and more. And it's one of the first communities in the United States that's truly about to be really, really harmed by climate change. Because again, if it didn't hurt to pull coal out of the ground and burn it, we'd still be doing it. Colstrip would be fine. The reason it is not going to happen anymore is because of climate change. So that community is at the forefront of how we're going to deal for the next 40 to 50 years with the changes in our economy wrought by decarbonizing. So how do we do that? I don't have the answer. My job, I think, right now is to, I mean, it's kind of, we're so late in the game. If I become the congressman, I think it's triage. And you have to be honest with people, and especially people in places like Colstrip, about what that means. My job is to ensure that this coming wrenching change in your life and your community is done with the least amount of pain for you, because this did not happen because you did anything wrong. And this is what government should do. We should that is the point of federal government specifically in this case. And, you know, there's people who are going to be underwater on their mortgages. There are people who are going to have invested in that place, in that community, in different ways. We either allow them a way to get out if they want to and find new employment and new lives, or if you would like to stay, we have to ensure that remains a viable community. And that includes offering the ability to be retrained, and also to ensure that the people, again, aren't underwater on their mortgages, that the schools are paid for, that we see a way forward. Mm-hmm. And I don't pretend to know what it is, but currently all the politicians do in Montana is just say we're going to save coal. And all they do is just lie to these people. And it's so offensive to me, and it should be offensive to them, that you have, you know, I mean, Greg Gianforte right now, I can bang up on him because he's going to be gone and I want to replace him. The guy just lies to them. He's a tech multimillionaire, the richest member of Congress. He has the gall to go to Colstrip, a community that is facing a huge wrenching change for people who work and make good money, but not like they didn't sell Cisco systems. They don't have hundreds of millions of dollars. They and their families won't be safe if this isn't done right. And what he does is lies to them and say he's going to save coal. I'm just tired of politics that rewards that kind of thing.
Right.
It's not right, and I don't understand how you can talk that way and be in a position of power and then afterwards be like, yep, time to go to bed. Like, I feel soundly sleeping in my soft bed at night that I just lied to a community about what's about to hit them. I just have no interest in doing that.
Yes.
So when you talk about fairness and doing the work, wanting to be elected, wanting to serve in office because you really want to help people, but it must be kind of frustrating when you hear about people that basically they're more interested in tearing the whole thing down. It really seems to us like, for instance, there was a situation here the other night at a fundraiser where we had, a state house member, Rodney Garcia, who said socialists should be shot or imprisoned because the Constitution says so. I mean, when you hear a statement like that by someone that you know, you served with in the legislature, how does that make you feel? And especially when you have a lot of the high-ranking GOP officials from Montana sitting right there, standing there next to him.
Yeah, I've spoken about this at length and written some op-eds. The phrase I use is one I never thought I'd use before, which is the fish rots from the head. And what we're seeing with Representative Garcia, a colleague of mine who I sat next to for probably 4 or 5 hours a day for 90 days in the service of the great people of Montana, was appalling and just so beyond the pale of acceptable discourse. Who talks this way? He represents a part of Billings. I can guarantee you absolutely no one in Billings thinks we should be murdering other people in Billings. That is what he's advocating. We need to get to that. He's talking about killing people. He said this in a closed door group in a room full of other fellow elected Republicans who I work with, and I thought also didn't want to kill people.
Right.
But there was silence in that room. He was talking to Representative Zinke, former head of the Department of the Interior,
right,
and our former congressman.
The
seat I'm running for. He said nothing, and I applaud them specifically, and it was a partisan act. I applaud the Republicans in the Montana State House for essentially disowning him.
Yes.
But
to their credit.
To their credit, they did that, but to their meager credit. The guy's talking, I mean, Representative Garcia, again, is advocating violence against his own constituents. And I'm just so disappointed that there would have been silence when he said it in a closed-door room, or that it took a few days for them to say it publicly, that they needed to get rid of him. And I just cannot advocate more strongly, one, for Representative Garcia to step down, because he can no longer serve having said this. There is no going back once you advocate violence against your own people. And number two, Hannah Olson will be running for his seat coming up, and I actually just met her last night. She is delightful, and more so than that, she is really, really dedicated to helping her district. One thing, she's not going to call for any violence against anybody, but more so than that, she's going to do what she can for her constituents. And I think the antidote to what's happening with Representative Garcia is thoughtful policy and people getting involved in thoughtful policy. Because otherwise, it's just so outrageous. What can you do?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and the behavior from, you know, the White House is not, it seems to sort of be, it's encouraging this kind of.
I agree, and more so than that, too. And this is, we were talking about this within the campaign. I don't want this to seem, when I'm speaking about the kind of, what seems to have been the moral compass being maybe lost a bit on the other side of the aisle. But, you know, we saw violence begets violence, and violent talk from government leaders begets violent talk from others in the citizenry. I mean, it's not just a Republican or Democrat thing. There was a gentleman in Missoula 2 days ago who was openly threatening to murder city councilmen. And from what it all appearances, he is a registered Democrat. I mean, it doesn't matter. You can't have people involved in public discourse who are threatening to hurt one another.
Exactly.
And we're already getting to that point.
Yes.
And what are we going to do when someone follows through on this? What do we do if Representative Garcia has inspired people to harm other legislators in his district or in Billings? Those are my colleagues, and they're Republicans and they're Democrats. I don't agree with them on everything, but they're humans, they're my friends, they're Montanans. They don't deserve to be walking in what is fear engendered by his comments. They're just, to say they're reckless is an understatement.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Before we wrap this up, we usually get around to this. This is a question.
Okay.
The question that I think is really relevant right now, in particular since what we've just gone through in the United States Congress impeachment trial, and at the heart of that impeachment was...
Do you believe it's appropriate for the President of the United States to ask a foreign leader to investigate a potential rival? Yes or no?
No. Loudly, strongly, and with conviction. This is something that I have... today the President was acquitted of these crimes in the Senate. So that was a political, of course, that's a political thing. That is not a trial, America and Montana. He is not acquitted. That does not mean he did not do them. It means that politically he was found that he did not need to suffer the consequences by the Senate. In their wisdom, they have made that choice. In my wisdom, as someone who's from Montana and knows what we need here, we need someone who will stand up for their own values and the values of this state. Things we do not do in this state. Use taxpayer funds to change the election outcome.
Right.
We believe in democracy, and we fight for it. And the thing that I'm doing every day, I get up early and work to become a congressman, which most of the people who today voted to acquit the president for what he clearly did, they would think I'm meaningless. They wouldn't care if once I got the job, they wouldn't think it's a big deal. They're senators. I'm so deeply offended because of the hard work that me and my campaign does. This is a slap in the face to anyone who's involved in public service. It's a slap in the face to anyone who cares about decency and morality. And it's a slap in the face to anyone who fought for this country. And I am so deeply tired of the cowardice of the people who claim to represent us and our values, because they don't if they voted this way. And if they answer yes to your question, I don't know what to say. Why are you in this? What is the point of debasing yourself and your community?
There's only one way to answer that question.
There is only one way to... No, the problem is there's one... You can say yes, and then you can go to jail. I mean, it's just astonishing to me. And in truth, also, I get worked up about this because I understand that this state voted for Donald Trump plus 22 points or 20 points or whatever. That is immaterial to whether or not what he did was wrong.
Right.
And I am not arguing against people who support him. I have many family members and friends that do. I live in Montana, after all. We can disagree, but this conduct is unconscionable and unacceptable. And if we don't have people calling it out, I don't know what we're going to do in this case. And I have to say, I have people I'm running against in my primary who refuse to say that this is wrong. They just will not answer your question.
I've asked one of our senators and our representative at large, and have not gotten a decent answer from them. It certainly wasn't.
Well, they tried not to answer.
The answer is yes or no.
Yeah,
and that's why
it's so happy,
and that's why I'm so appreciative that you're asking it. I just this matters, and I think what Representative Schiff was talking about, you know, in America, right matters.
Yeah,
that's true.
Yeah.
And if it's not true, then what are you fighting for? What's the point of doing this? Right. Go get a different job.
Right. Well, I think that hopefully covered a lot of ground. What we're trying to do is, you know, with these interviews is to not cover everything you are interested in or that we're interested in. It's what drives the process. What are the important things? And bringing up the moral issues, I think, is really important. We often don't get that far, but so I appreciate what you bring to the table. And any last words or
sure. I guess I'm, of course, right after this, I'm going to say, why didn't I say this and why didn't I say it better? But I am there. There's a lot of people and a lot of really good people working in politics right now to right this ship. I don't think anyone's going to say it's going well. And I don't think anyone's going to say a lot of things are going well. It's clear that Montanans and Americans are concerned about the direction of our country, our society. The entire project that we've been working on for 200 years is I think everyone agrees that there are problems. I am working earnestly to provide answers to those problems. And I hope people can join me, whether or not they agree or disagree with me, or if they're a member of the Democrats or Republicans, to find answers that answer it in a Montana way. Because we have specific views here, we have specific lives, the rest of the country doesn't understand us. They never have, and they might not ever. That's just fine. That's why you elect people, hopefully like me, but others. That's why you elect John Tester, you elect Steve Daines in your wisdom, you elect Steve Bullock, that's why you elect Greg Gianforte. We do this because we have a viewpoint that others don't. And I am respectful of that and appreciative of that. And I want to make sure that when we make choices, we make ones that are in our best interest. And so I hope people can help me do that. I'm obviously going to be everywhere. And I hope I can come back and be on your program. This was great.
Tom Winter, thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Yes, thank you.
Well, again, a big thank you to Tom Winter for interviewing with us. I think that was, to me, he strikes me as a, and I don't get this wrong, but as a grassroots politician. In other words, he got into this because he was very upset with the way healthcare was working, his own and other people's. And then he had an extensive experience in canvassing people.
Right, what he right. Did and he obviously was listening when he was canvassing mm-hmm. those people, you know, and he took those people's concerns to the state legislature, and he tried to get some bills passed. So he was actually listening to his constituents, a rather quaint, old-fashioned way of being a representative, I would say.
Yeah, and then he took what he heard and translated it into, I believe, 24 bills that he introduced himself or in combination with somebody, and four of which he actually got passed, which for a first-year person is quite an achievement. So he does represent, to me anyway, a certain kind of politician who bases what he does on what he hears from his constituents.
Right, right. And it's pretty obvious, too, that he has a lot of integrity, and he has some definite goals, you know, ideals that he wants to make things better for people. And that's great.
Yeah, and he's not afraid to bring things up that are controversial.
Oh, certainly not.
Or difficult, or even that he knows won't pass, but he wants to do it to kind of lay down the marker.
Right, his heart's in the right place.
So all in all, it's an interesting interview, and I hope people enjoy it. So with that, we'll wrap up A Podcast Runs Through It. Thank you very much for listening. Bye for now.